Hi, y'all.
This is my second trip to Austin, and I've even enjoyed this one more than the first, so thank you very much. This is a terrific facility. The first time I've been here, I'm from Indianapolis. We've heard of this place as it's kind of the Mecca, you know, all that kind of stuff, but I hadn't had the privilege of being here. Looking at your wall with Mark's lineage, with seeing Joe Hawk and Mark and Don and Gary. Gary and I share a home group together and a lot of other good stuff. And I knew Gary's mentor, Paul from Martin from the Chicago. So, it's all in the family. And what I love seeing this group here, I'm not sure which direction I'm going to go because I'm so moved by what I see here. See, I was brought up, that man Don wasn't ever my sponsor, let's be clear. He was my big brother and he was my dear friend and so forth. Matter of fact, I asked him to sponsor me and he said no. He says, what do you think you're going to get from me being your sponsor that you don't get from me being your friend? And you know, I didn't have a good enough answer for him to overcome that. But when I called Don to complain about a meeting I was going to, and it was running rampant, I thought, you know, we were having it in this facility that in daytime they had daycare there. And so parents would bring little kids and they'd jump on these tricycles and ride them between the tables in the meetings. And all it was just, in my mind, chaos. We need to get some real order here. People are staying incorrectly sober. And by the way, incorrect sobriety is a real threat, you know. We've got to stamp out incorrect sobriety. But Don said, Mike, he says, if AA is about anything at all, it's about healing families and building new ones. Those children aren't an interruption. They're what we're about. And I'm so glad that if you come to my home group and you want to bring your child and you will both be welcome and we'll let you know that you're welcome. We won't tolerate you. We'll let you know you're welcome because you're a wonderful reminder about what we really need to be about here. I'm going to try and get... I need to get cooler here too. Thank you. I want to try and get the road behind us, behind me in this talk as quickly as possible because I think the important thing is we all need to think about the road in front of us and what that may look like. I grew up in a college town in Iowa City, Iowa, a Big Ten college town. When I grew up there, it was 50,000 permanent residents, 25,000 students at the university. It was, you know, looked like something out of, I can't say Beaver Cleaver anymore. That's out of date. I was informed that nobody knows who Beaver was anymore. So. But I'm the oldest of four kids. I'm the only alcoholic I found for years in my family. I've got a nephew that's now working on 5 years, but I couldn't find any, look around me and see any alcoholics, and that puzzled me for a period of time. I got to tell you, I came from a functional family. I won't tell you it was a normal family because I was in it, but it was what I mean by a functional family is when trouble came up in that family, the other family members faced that trouble and dealt with it as honestly and as best they could. And it wasn't always perfectly, but there wasn't anybody pretending something wasn't going on. I was a power seeker, am a power seeker all my life, and before I found alcohol, I got my power from pleasing adults. I was the little suck-up that would come over to your house in your... Folks had asked me to stay for dinner, and after dinner was over, I'd jump up and start carrying the plates out in the kitchen and rinsing them, and sooner or later, your mom might say to me, you know, Joey, why can't you be like that nice Lorenz boy? And I got that little bump that I needed. And I worked in the principal's office, and I got good grades, and I did all this kind of stuff. And I'm not doing this because I'm a particularly good kid. I'm doing this because I need what it's giving me, or what I think it's giving me. And so when I'm 11 years old, I happen to stumble across, I'd had sips of beers and a little wine at a holiday, but I got a hold of enough vodka when I was 11 that the miracle that's described on page 27 of our basic text occurred for me. And right there, Carl Jung's having a conversation with an appropriately named drunk by the name of Roland Hazard, and he's trying to get over to Roland what this spiritual awakening or spiritual experience idea might be like. And, you know, Roland says, well, I go to church. And he says, no, that's not what we're talking about here. And he goes on, he says, ideas and emotions that guided the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side and a new set of conceptions takes hold. And I got it when Don laid that out for me. See, once I found what the vodka would do with me, in very short order, I didn't need the good grades, I didn't need the principal's office job, I didn't need to please your mother. In fact, whatever. I mean, my parents thought there was a demon possession going on in our house, you know, because what happened to the honor student? What happened to the kid that was always helpful and all that kind of stuff? And I didn't know until many years later, until Don so lovingly took me into there, that what had happened with the vodka, of course some intoxication happened, but what really happened was an artificial spiritual awakening produced by alcohol. It's not an accident they call alcohol spirits over the centuries, you know? And I didn't know, 11-year-old Mike didn't know what he needed was a spiritual awakening. Wouldn't have known how to go look for one or anything else. But I stumbled across one in a bottle, and after that you weren't going to get between me and that bottle and later a bunch of other stuff. Now, that wasn't all bad. Because what it did is it allowed a very frightened, insecure kid from a small Midwestern town to go to college, go to the Army, go to Vietnam, go to the big city and do some stuff in business and all that stuff. I don't know that I could have ever left my little block in Iowa City without some flight fuel. But just so you know what the drinking looked like, I think we can box it up pretty quickly. I'm 16 years old, and I've got my buddy with me, and we're in my car, and we're riding around out in the county outside that city, and the red light goes on. We're drinking some beer, of course, and the red light goes on, and it's Barney Fife, the deputy sheriff, is pulling me over. I remember this small town. I'm living in Mayberry, Iowa, practically. So they know me. They know my folks. Everybody knows everybody here. So I turn to my friend and I says, "Watch this." I get out of my car. I walk back to Barney and I'm waving at him and all that. And he kind of starts to smile. And when I came up to him next to that cruiser, I grabbed him and I slammed him down across the hood of that patrol car and took his gun away from him. And then I turned around and I gave his gun back to him. And Barney was upset. And he yelled and he screamed and he hollered. But in the end, he did about what I figured he'd do. He poured out my beer and told me to get the hell out of there. And the most important thing about that, of course, I wanted to get cut loose, but the most important thing was my buddy was watching out the back window of that car and saw that all happen. So that story was all over my high school the next day. And I started to get a little reputation. And, you know, if you don't feel like you're anybody, you need to be somebody. And my calculation was this guy is never going to go back to that sheriff's substation and admit in front of all his buddies that this kid took his gun away. He'd have to listen to that for the rest of his career, and he wouldn't be about to do that. And one more time. See, I thought I was a smart guy, but I'm just moving myself a little further down the road. About a year later, I'm probably a junior in high school by this time, and we have a major injustice in the Lorenz household. Instead of buying me the Corvette I thought I deserved, my father bought my mother a new car. And it was terrible because he bought her about the lamest car you could buy at the time. He bought her a tan Buick four-door hardtop. You know, just, you know, not cool at all. And so I'm honestly indignant about this. So Mom was always one of my buddies, and so in about a week's time or 2 weeks' time, I convinced Mom that she ought to lend me that car for a date, and so I went out on a date in the lame car, and I don't remember much about the date, but after the date was over, I got together with a couple of my buddies, and we started drinking and talking about the injustice and the lameness of this car. And so sometime after midnight, we end up down in my friend's father's machine shop, and my buddy's helpfully putting a cutting torch into my hand, and I decided, well, if I couldn't have my Corvette, I'd have a convertible. So I proceeded to cut the roof off Mom's new car. Sunday morning, when my parents are bringing my sister and younger brothers out to take them to church, they come out of the garage, and here's kind of the smoking hulk of Mom's car with Big Brother stretched out naked across the front seat. And all I remember the whole thing was my mother screaming, don't hit him, Art, you know. You get a focus of what the drinking looked like, you know, and pretty much right out of the box. And I tell you this because I got sober under the delusion that somewhere around about the time when I was, you know, 27, 28, that I started to have a problem with my drinking. You know? And again, loving people walked me back through all of that. And I said, no, my drinking had never been normal. There was drinking without consequences, but no normal drinking. So all the stuff happened, and, you know, I went to the war, I survived the war, I came back, got a business career, succeeded, failed, and at the end of the day, I'm living a drunk life, and I need to get sober, and there's not time for that story. But where I end up with is I finally end up on the front doorstep of the parents of that guy that owned the machine shop, that guy. And he and his wife had gotten sober about 7 years before. And I hadn't liked it because Buck had always been a good old boy, and he'd always slip me a little money or slip me a little liquor or something. And you know, now I thought he and his wife had gotten sober and square, and, you know, I think church puppies was about the nicest thing I called them. I'm dying, and I can't make it to the treatment facility. This is not my first treatment facility. I've been trying for 6 years now without getting any traction. And I knock on the door, and Buck and Nettie came to the door, and they looked at me, and they looked at each other, and they just pulled me into the room. And they stood there and put their arms around me and said a prayer right then and there for me to get better. And the miracle was that I stood still for that prayer. If they'd said that prayer a week earlier, I would have pushed them away. And Buck gave me another drink, put me to bed, and took me on to that treatment facility the next day with another drink, my last drink to this day. They had the same 12 steps at that place that they had at the previous five places. And everything what had changed was me. My level of willingness was changed. And So I went through the program there, came out with a firm resolution, and I got to tell you, because of this crowd, in case anybody thinks you need special conditions, when I got out of treatment, I did what every successful guy does. I went home to mommy's, and dad was dead by this time, but I went home to mommy's in my old bedroom, and my youngest brother, not an alcoholic, had just started his career as a wine distributor, and my old bedroom was his first warehouse. So my first night out of treatment, they've got to make a little hole in his inventory, and they put a rollaway bed in there, and I've got cases of wine stacked to the ceiling on three sides of me while I'm sleeping. But his inventory was safe and protected. Yeah. And it has been to this day. Such is the power of surrender. Now I want to talk about the road ahead, because you don't need to make this road as long as I made it. But what I did, because I'm too smart for my own good. You know, I surrender and then my ego starts to reinflate. You know, and it doesn't look like ego to me. It looks like I just kind of know. Oh, I get that. I know that. Well, I always was used to being kind of one of the quick kids in class that didn't have to study very hard. And I figured that AA would be another place like that, where I could just kind of use my God-given talents to float through. And they boomeranged on me. I went back to Indianapolis and I started what I call my junior guru phase in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to 11 meetings a week. I've got every service position possible. I carry a meeting into the Salvation Army on Sunday nights into their detox unit. You know, I'm a GSR. I'm an intergroup rep. I'm an everything you can think of. I get my life rebuilds. I'm sober. I meet and marry a wonderful woman in alcohol in AA. She's got a 1 year 1 year 3 month old son when we get together. So now I've got a stepson. I'm back living on the cul-de-sac. I mean, you know, ain't it grand? The wind stopped blowing, and I don't want to drink. Don't want to drink. But I'm here to tell you, as I approach my fifth anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm considering suicide with a sincerity and desperation I never had when I was drinking. I am more hopeless than I ever was behind a drink. And let me tell you why. Because when I was drinking, I could always hope that, you know, I'd say, well, maybe someday I'll get sober and it'll be okay. And it turns out, oh, I love that. I get sober in the drinking. Go away, because see, probably much like some of you, people have told me all my life, you know, Mike, if you just didn't drink, you'd be one of our best students. If you just didn't drink, you'd be, you know, we promote you in this corporation. If you just didn't drink, I might keep this engagement ring. If you just didn't drink, you know, fill in the blank. And here I am, 5 years sober. I mean, I even founded my own AA meeting, so there'd be one correctly done there. You know, I mean, you know, nobody else does it quite like we want it done, you know. And here I am, further in the drink than I can ever imagine I'd be. I don't want to drink, but I don't know it. I'm dying from untreated alcoholism. And that's when I encountered that man, Don and Gary on the wall, and some of those guys, and got into that family. And Don said the words that changed my life. He says, Mike, he says, what you don't understand is, he says, sobriety is not your solution, it's your problem. And he took me right in. He says, look, you're as sober as you're ever going to be right now. And what? You want to kill yourself, right? The beautiful wife isn't going to fix it. The new cars you've got in your garage isn't going to fix it. All this stuff, the business success you're starting to have isn't going to fix it. There's nothing you're going to find that's going to fill a God-sized hole. And it turned out what I'd done here in Alcoholics Anonymous was a great deal like what I'd done when I went to the University of Iowa years before. I went over and I signed up for all my classes, went and bought my books at the student bookstore, joined a fraternity, threw the books in the closet, and started a party. And if you ran into me on campus and asked me what I was doing, I said, well, I'm a pre-law student here at the University of Iowa, sir. And that's technically true, but I'm rarely going to class, you know. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't miss a meeting, I don't miss a roundup, I don't miss a dance, I don't miss anything, I just miss the program. Now, I'm that worst of all character. I'm a slogan slinger in meetings. I pretend because I'm a quick study. I'll go to a meeting and I hear things. So, you know, well, you ought to just turn that over. Oh, really? How the hell would I go about turning it over? You know? I don't. If you'd asked me, I wouldn't have had a clue. I'm not paying any attention. See, I've got this idea that sober is going to fix it all, so I don't hear this wife that I love saying things to me like, Mike, being married to you is the loneliest thing I've ever tried to do. Mike, if I let you sponsor me, could I have one of those intimate conversations that I hear you have with the men you work with? You know, I know more about what you think, feel, and believe by listening to your end of one side of a telephone conversation than anything you'll say directly to me. My stepson, Andrew, one of my best teachers. 4 years old, I'm picking him up and bringing him home from daycare. He turns to me and says, you know, Mike, he says, I think your life might go better if you started saying the second thing that comes to your mind. I need this from a 4 year old, you know. Yeah. I know nothing about being a dad, so I'm going, Lori, what do I do? She says, pay attention to your show. But not far from that same time, you know, we have another one of those meetings, he and I, and he says, Mike, you need to understand that I've got plenty of friends. I need you to be my dad. In other words, quit messing around and show up like an adult in his life. But I'm missing this. See, they aren't the problem. And I found further from the brink than I could ever be. I found out there was still time to wake up and discover the program Alcoholics Anonymous is. Revolutionized my life. Now I come from a tradition where we don't just talk about this stuff in the general way. We get specific about it. So I'm going to share some very specific stuff with you, and that's because my Don said, you know, if you can't convince an alcoholic why they should do something and what's in it for them, they're never going to do it, no matter how lofty and good it sounds. You know, it's just it's the way it is, and that's kind of been my experience. And so, some of you either have or will have a fourth step experience for it in front of you, along with a really, an ongoing process of self-examination in steps 10 and 11. And here's the way this showed up at a point in my life, because I like this piece because there's a thread to it. That marriage ended, obviously, because I was a jerk. The first thing I could be grateful was that I was a jerk, but I wasn't an unfaithful jerk, so... the divorce that I didn't want to have happened, and I've now got a job as a 3 day a week dad, and I got busy with that 3 day a week deal. And I already told you a little bit about Andrew. Well, he's 6 and a half, 7 now, and so we're getting ready for one weekend, and Andrew says, Mike, I don't want you taking me to any of those kids' places tonight. He says, I want to go to a real restaurant. Take me to a grown-up restaurant. No Applebee's or McDonald's playground or any of that stuff. I want to go to a real restaurant with napkins, you know. And so, who knows where he gets this stuff, but, you know. So So I take him to the restaurant, and we're sitting there, and you know, he's good company, as you might guess, and we're having a good time. And all of a sudden, I look up and look around me, and it's, you know, it's Friday night, and this whole place is full of couples in love. And I'm sitting there with a six-year-old. Oh God, the self-pity tsunami just washes over me. You know, look what God has done to me. You know, so I'm now on a different path and a different basis. So I refocus my attention on him. We finish our dinner. We go home. We do the video. We do a bath. We do a story, and I put him to bed. As soon as his little butt hits the bed, I'm out writing an inventory, and I am mad, and I am mad at God, because God has done, look what God has done to me. So, and by the way, I don't present any of this stuff that I share is the perfect way to do this. See, my inventory only needs to be good enough to keep me alive to get to the next piece of self-examination. Perfection is a child of my ego that will keep me from taking effective action. My experience, anyway. So, anyway, I resent God. Why do I resent God? I resent God because I don't have the relationship that I want to have with a woman. I think that God will only give me the choice between having a sick relationship or no relationship. I'm lonely. People with less recovery, people I sponsor, are having better relationships than I am. I'm afraid God will keep me in this pain because I'll be more useful to others than if I have the relationship I fantasize about. I told you. It actually gets worse. I feel like God has given me a gift of communicating with others, and the price of the gift is my own happiness. I'm mad because I know that only God can help me, and I don't believe He will. You know, get down off the cross, Mike. You know. Well, what's this affects? Well, it affects my self-esteem. I feel like I'd sell out my principles to have a comfortable relationship. For example, I might do something like hitting on a newcomer. As a result, I feel like a phony. Todd said, Mike, that's because you're a phony. Simple answers. You know, Don, I feel so ashamed. You should be. Oh. That's the image you're coming to here. It's distorting my sex relationships. I'm having an increasingly emotionally unsatisfactory sex-only relationship. I decided the answer was to outsource my sex life. This was before outsourcing was really fashionable, but I decided I don't want to cause harm in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I meet and I develop a relationship with a woman who is not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We agree, no cards, no flowers, no dates, no dinners, no movies. And this was pre-cell phone days, so we couldn't text each other or anything. So we had a code word. We call each other secretaries and set up a date to play racquetball was the code word. And the deal, and this isn't working for me, obviously. And Don pointed out to me that was good news. See, he said, Mike, if you were a kind of guy who could take advantage of another human being, even a consenting one, in that fashion, there would be little hope of you ever having a real relationship. He said, be glad that you can't do that. Oh, didn't know. So, affecting my personal relations, keeping me jealous of others, comparing myself to them, coveting what I think they've got. I'm unwilling to share my pain. I feel ashamed, flawed, apart from, indifferent. My unbalanced drive in this area makes me vulnerable to getting drunk, constant compromising my principles will get me drunk, and I know I don't have the strength not to do this. My mistakes. The infamous column 4 here. Well, I'm not willing to give this to God because I don't think He's interested or willing to help me. Now, that doesn't sound like much, does it? Especially in the context of all of this stuff. But it turns out that's a spiritual death sentence. That's the essence of what an old idea is. We heard about it when we heard how it works tonight. Some of us have held on to our old ideas. How about an old idea of God doesn't really want me happy? God doesn't really care about my sex life. God just wants me to work hard and be a good little boy and doesn't care about anything else in my life. Or God can or won't help me in this area. I put myself outside the realm of divine help with that. And I didn't realize I was really doing very much at all. It didn't sound like much. No, God just doesn't care about my sex life or my personal life in that area. I mean, it just sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Yeah. Big deal. Big deal. And until I see it on the page in my own handwriting, I don't understand how big a deal it is. I'm willing to sell out all my principles for relief. You know, like Don says, you don't want this right, you must want this right now. You know, I'm impatient. You know, do it now. I'm not willing to take an honest look at what this fantasy relationship won't do for me. See, I'm pretending that she and this relationship, which I plan to be a really good guy in, by the way, I pretend that this is going to fix it all. And that's a lie. And I want somebody else to fill me up and make me feel safe and secure. Well, I finished right... Now, see how I didn't have to join a workshop, do months worth of work. The kid's in bed. By 9:30, I've got this written. I'm on the telephone calling Gary across town, fifth-stepping this with him. I finish talking with Gary, and I come from a tradition where we get a couple different takes on this, so I call Don in Denver. And I called Don, and you know, you heard part of the feedback there. But Don's big instruction to me, though, was he said, "Mike, I want you to do this and this only." He says, "I want you to start saying this prayer." And I said, "Okay, Don, what's your prayer?" He says, "God, please teach me about love." And I said, "Thanks, God, Don." You know, and I called Clinton, California, because again, I don't understand. I don't get a real answer when it's staring me in the face. And part of my deal with Don was that if I didn't like the results I got from his advice, I could call him back and complain. So about 2 weeks later, I called Don up and I says, "Don, you need to know I don't think much of your damn prayer." And he says, "Well, tell me about that, cowboy." And I said, "Well, since I started saying that prayer, the only woman I was really thought I had a future with and was interested, she got a job transfer and her company sent her out of town to another city. And to put it, you know, on top of it, I went to see my doctor and he said I had high blood pressure and he's given me some medication that's made me impotent, you know." And Don just laughed. And he says, I think you misunderstood the prayer." He says, "The prayer is, God, please teach me about love." He says, "Mike, you're a man who knows a great deal about sex and you know nothing about love. Work with me on this." And see, love is the answer all the way around. I was willing to take Don's direction. I was willing to do all of this because I knew he loved me. I wouldn't have listened to this from somebody else without that element of love there. Our conversations, especially the difficult ones, would always start, "You know I love you, don't you, Mike?" I said, "Yes, Don, I believe you do." He says, "Well, Mike, knowing that I love you, you know if there was any way I could tell you how to have a successful sick relationship, I'd do it, don't you?" He says, "Unfortunately, there isn't, so I can't." But he asked me to keep working with him, and I did. And a couple weeks later, Marva, I all of a sudden had the most marvelous experience. I realized that I'd fallen wildly head over heels in love with my son. He and his mom had always been a little closer and a little more special and everything else. And all of a sudden, that barrier went away, and it's gone away to this day. That's more than 20 years ago, and it's gone to this day right now. And then the next thing in the timeline that happened, I realized that I'd fallen in love with my former wife. and I didn't want to marry her again. But what I can tell you happened was that God restored her to the place she had in my heart before we got married and started what we did there. And matter of fact, she's a wonderful friend to this day, and we've swapped inventories and everything else. You ever want to have some ego reduction? Listen to your former wife's inventory. Find out how small a part you actually played in your life. matter of fact, the first thing we would do after the divorce was over is we went to a PTA meeting together, and we were leaving that PTA meeting, and I turned to her and I says, you know, Lori, I think the only bad feeling I've got left about the divorce is that it interrupted our friendship. And she turns to me with a Katie Parker smile and she says, Mike, you still don't get it, do you? And I said, what? And she says, Mike, it was the marriage that interrupted our friendship. And the way we went about that. And so I'm learning bits and pieces about love. And I'm learning them from former wives, and I'm learning it from little kids and so forth. And as I go along, eventually, one of the things that Don had told me too was the old guy. He says, tell me about this woman you think that's going to just change it all for you. So I did. And he kind of chuckled. He says, well, on the off chance such a woman actually exists on the planet, why would she want to have anything to do with you? I said, geez, Don, that's pretty cold. And he says, no, it was the fall. He says, look out in the sky tonight. He says, you'll see the geese coming over flying with the geese, and the ducks will be flying with the ducks, and there won't be a cow in the middle of either one of those formations. You know? If you want that woman in your life, you have to become. It's not finding her, it's becoming somebody that woman would want to be with, and then she will show up in your life. You won't have to track her down. And a few years later, a wonderful, wonderful bright light, a gal who'd been a friend of mine in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'd gone out on the road and done speaking and workshops together and everything else, but she was way too young and too cute and too everything for me, and she walked across the parking lot after we'd done a workshop locally one Saturday, and she says, Mike, you need to know I love you. And I said, well, that's nice, Linda. She says, no, focus. she says, I really love you. I mean it. Now give me a real hug, not one of those AA air hugs, you know. And we started a wonderful, having a wonderful time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don just loved her like a rainbow, and they were pals, and we all just had a great time. And I came home. I went out to. Oh, part of her rules, by the way, is, you know, I'm not going to be your shack 'em up honey, so we're not living together till we're married. She also showed up on, I think, about our third dangerous date. I went over to pick her up, and she handed me this piece of paper, and I said, what's this? And she says, well, I've put some thoughts down on paper, but the primary purpose for our relationship ought to be, and I think I'd like to see yours pretty soon. And she'd stand at the podium and tell you that her primary purpose for our relationship was so detailed and fine-tuned that it described the color, clarity, and weight of the diamond I was supposed to buy. And she said, mine was so vague and general that it could have described my relationship with a cat. So, well, you know, we got to leave room to grow. And, you know, and thank God for her, because, see, this is where we build a relationship. Relationships are built. I'll share with you here, because two things that I do carry and so I can remember what's the primary purpose of my relationship and what's my conduct ideal. So before I get to make any decision, I've I need to look myself in the eye and read this. This is who I said I wanted to be, and this is what we said we wanted to be together. We will practice the active support of the growth and well-being of each other's spiritual condition. We will honor and express God's love and devotion within our relationships so that we may worship and serve God together and when we're apart. Honor the holiness of marriage, the sanctity of service to others, and the delight of living and loving each other without fear. For me, I'll try to be the best of lovers by being the best of friends and seeking each day to contribute to rather than take from you in our relationship. My love for you doesn't give me special privileges, it gives me special responsibilities. I will listen to you and to God, and you will teach me how to do this if I'm faithful and attentive. That wasn't the guy that started writing this inventory. And so when I go out of town, I'd frequently leave my car over at Linda's. She lived near the airport, and so I'd do that and pick it up when I got back to town. And this time when I got back to town from Santa Fe, she wasn't at the airport. And I made a few calls and to no avail, so I hired a cab and went over to her house and let myself in and found her on the floor of the bathroom. She collapsed that morning while she was getting ready for work. Her coffee was sitting on the sink. And she was conscious when I found her but unable to speak. And we got the paramedics going and got her to the house. We went to neurointensive care and we were there 5 days and it looked like we were getting better. And then I got the word that we were going to have to go to hospice, that the bleeding in her head had taken off again and had crushed her brainstem. And so I'm standing in hospice, standing by her bed, holding her hand on the last night of her life. And I'm going, oh God, oh yeah, teach me about love. Yeah, give me this gift. Let me open myself up, really. And look what you do to me. And thank God, the first thing I could be grateful for was another lesson that Don had given me. He says, Mike, as near as I can tell, there will always be at least two of you showing up in every situation. There's the selfish, self-centered little so-and-so, and then there's the guy who, honest to God, wants to do the right thing. He says, now you can't wish that other guy away. He says, it's like having a wet drunk in a meeting. If you try and shut them up, they just get louder, but you don't let them run the meeting either. So I couldn't shut down the voice that's saying, this is wrong. You know, I'm 12 years older than her. She's supposed to be taking care of me when I die. This is, blah, 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 blah. And thank you for sharing. And I didn't have to be tied up somewhere else, and I could be fully present for the last hours of her life, and I didn't miss that with her. And so where did the prayer go after that? Well, it turns out the next piece of the prayer was me learning how to accept love from others. Yeah. And that's a frightening prospect. See, when I'm the person doling out the love, I decide how much there's going to be, how long it's going to last, and what it's going to look like. But when I'm receiving it from you, you're making all those decisions. What if I'm just starting to count on you loving me and you decide that's enough? And I had no idea that fear was there. And so I got to learn another set of lessons. And we're in a community where lots of people love us both incredibly. And now it moved on to another thing. I guess I call them my friends without benefits. I've got a whole bunch of just wonderful women in my life, and they're deep, deep, intimate friends. And it's funny, Don would always tell me that, you know, that real happiness lay in learning to live in the matriarchy. He says, you know, women are the ones that have got it going on. And, you know, much more intuitive and, you know, all those gifts. And, you know, if I'm willing to give up being the hunter, you know, see, because the prey never relaxes when the hunter's around. You know, they're always on guard. But if I'm willing to give up being the hunter, then I can have the gift of those intimate relationships. And they're far more intimate than anything that ever happens between the sheets, where you really know what happens to each other at a soul level. And so I get to experience that love and all that. And I don't have any idea what the next lesson is going to be, but I'm sure it's going to be there. One thing that I would like to... I went a little longer than I would in this other area, but I want to tell you about some of you may have been or will be involved in situations where amends with children are involved. And I want to share my experience with that with you. Back in the drinking days, I landed in a relationship with this gal who had two small children, Summer and Erica, 2 years old and 4 years old. And we were together. I never married Mom, but we were together for about 5 years. And so I did all this work, and I was kind of an alcoholic upgrade. Dad had been a violent biker guy who deserted the family and took off for Arizona. And I arrived, and instead of a six-pack, I got a bottle of Bordeaux under my arm and a cashmere jacket, but I'm still a jerk, you know, I'm a drunk. I'm just drinking better stuff. And so I show up, and I have a five-year impact in the life of the mom and these girls. And so later, much later on, it's time to make amends, and I figure, well, this is going to be no big deal because... Jan's my barber, and so I never quit seeing her as a friend and so forth, so making amends to her is going to be easy. So I showed up to make amends to Jan, made an appointment, and by this time you've coached me well. The first thing you're going to hear from me is, you know, you're square with me. Now that piece isn't in the book. That piece is for me because, as my ex-wife put it, Mike, you're the kind of guy who puts rocks in snowballs. Which means I'm clever enough with words that a lot of people I trained them not to, that they couldn't or shouldn't trust me. So I needed to make it clear that there's no angle here. You're all square with me. I'll tell you I'm wrong. Not sorry, wrong. And that had a powerful impact because I'd say I was sorry, or I'd have an explanation or something, but I'd always work it around to where you kind of had a part in it. You know, if you'd been a little better, I wouldn't have had to be so evil, you know. So I'm just going to tell you, I was wrong. And then here's what I did. But I'm really trying to do is get to the place where you tell me how I hurt you. See, the important part for me to try and heal is not what I think I did to you, but how you experienced the hurt and the harm from me. And that requires me to be a listener, not a talker. Just start the conversation and then listen actively. And I listen very closely, and so I did that stuff with Jan, and she says, well, you know, I see you bring Andrew into the barbershop, and I can tell by the way he is around you that he loves you a great deal and you're a good dad. And I'm going, yeah, I'm a good dad. She says, and that really pisses me off. She says, my girls deserve that from you, and you didn't give it to them. You ripped them off. And then she went on to, we had about a 40-minute chat that was not comfortable at all. And she and I got square, and then I said, well, I need to do something with the girls, obviously. By this time, they're early teenagers. And she said, well, I don't know if I want you to have anything to do with them. And I said, well... So anyway, where it comes out is that she said, I'll tell you what, if you want to, you can write them a letter. And if they want to have anything to do with you beyond that, it'll be up to them. So here's the letter that went out. Now, I've since had the opportunity to work with a lot of guys that need to make amends to their kids or whomever, and turns out that by accident I did something that is very effective today. You know, we go to workshop or we go wherever we go and we spend weeks writing inventory and talking to sponsors and doing stuff and getting ready for amends, and then we just kind of go vomit this hairball in some child's lap, you know, and wonder why we don't get a reaction that's cool, you know. Turns out it's very good today. My guys will either write an email, send a letter, whatever, and let their kids sit with it for a while and say, you know, honey, when you're ready to talk with this, if ever, you know, I'm open to a conversation with you. And I'd sure like to hear what this looks like from your side of the street, your angle. But anyway, here's the way it happened back then. Dear Summer, I'm writing to do what I can to set right the harm that I did during the years that I was in relationship with your mom. I'm chosen to type this rather than phone for two reasons. First, my handwriting's pretty hard to read. And second, because I want you to have something tangible that you can look at later when life may be treating you rough. To tell the truth, I'm tempted to let things just stay the way they are because your mom tells me that you have a few good memories of the time we spent together. Part of me says, why mess with that? The best answer I have is that I love you, and I'm certain deep in my heart, whether you know it yet or not, I've done you harm. I'm sure you were aware during those years we were together that I was an active alcoholic, and they made me put the next part in bold italics. Let me be very clear that this in no way whatsoever relieves me of responsibility for my actions. I used alcohol and drugs because they were the only things that I knew that could give me relief from the constant fear I felt. I was drawn to you and the family because I desperately wanted to love and be loved, but I was also scared to death at the prospect of being responsible. Emotionally, I felt like I had one foot on the gas and the other on the brake. I'm sure that it was hard for you to figure out what was real. Is the real Mike the one who wants to love me or the one who pushes me away? You weren't crazy. I was. You were a wonderful, lovable child, and you had every right to expect consistent love, emotional support, and parenting from me. What you got instead was fear, chaos, confusion, and abandonment. I want you to know that I didn't fail to give you those things because you were unlovable or undeserving, but because I was a sick and frightened man incapable of giving. If you feel emotionally ripped off, it's because you were. If you feel abandoned, you're not crazy, you were. I know at some deep emotional level it's hard not to feel that if you were really worthy and valuable that these things wouldn't have happened. Please believe me that this just isn't so. You are worthy and deserving of love both then and now. It was I that failed you. Summer, I hope you'll accept my heartfelt regret for these and the unlisted harms I've done. Should you ever want to talk about any of this, please give me a call. If I can ever be of any help to you as a friend, I'd be honored. And then P.S., I'm sending a similar letter to Erica since I also harmed her. And there wasn't any quick magic answer. But I did get invited to her high school graduation. And then the fall after that graduation, we got word from Arizona that she always called her real dad, bio dad. She, bio dad, died an alcoholic death. He had a hemorrhage in his throat and choked to death on his own blood in a flop house in Phoenix. And a few days later, I got a call from Summer, and she said, Mike, do you remember that letter you sent me? And I said, sure I do. She says, you know, that was the letter that I always hoped I'd get from my dad someday. But since he'll never be able to send it, I think God had you send it for him. See, and I got a whole different view of this deal here. What I'm really part of is I'm a part of God's, what I call God's recycling program. You know, if you ask me a question, Mike, do you want to terrify children? Of course not. Do you want to break up a family? Of course not. Do you want to do it? Of course not. I'm not a sociopath or a psychopath. But I see, I'm so into self that I don't even see you in my way when you're, you know, and so you become like the phrase today is collateral damage, you know. And so what it turns out is that to this day, when I go out and I do create some harm, if I will put it in God's recycling plan through our 12 steps, go out, make amends where appropriate, and do all of this, that God seems to be able to turn that into an instrument of healing for others that I don't understand. And this isn't the only case where that's happened. We're out of time. I can't tell you any more about it. I will just close with, let Summer, in her own words, kind of describe where things are. Michael, this was after her wedding. Michael, thank you so much for sharing my day with me. It seems like just yesterday you were chasing us around and bopping us with those foam bats. Those were great times. I'm glad you were here to see me all grown up on my day. It wouldn't have been the same without you. Hope your holidays are wonderful. Please stay in touch. Love and kisses, Summer. I'm the crazy guy that used to just sit there at the end of the evening pounding on the bar or my coffee table and going, it's not fair, it's not fair, damn it, it's not fair. And I'm here to tell you from the bottom of my heart tonight, thank God it's not fair. So thank you very much for being with us.